This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story, Why Foodies Flock to Durham. As the Bull City becomes a regional restaurant mecca, Raleigh searches for the right recipe. And that's the headline on the front page. The story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline. What's piquing the Triangle palate? Raleigh has not yet managed to replicate Durham's diverse culinary offerings and reputation as a foodie town. And this article is written by Jeff Jeffrey. Durham restaurateur Scott Howell is a hard guy to track down these days. He's in the final stages of opening a new Italian steakhouse in the Aloft Hotel building on the American Tobacco campus. In between meetings with his financial partners, Howell is overseeing the construction of the new space as he prepares for the restaurant's opening early next year. Nana Steak will be the fourth addition to Howell's restaurant offerings in Durham, which are led by his flagship, Nana's on University Drive. He hopes the new eatery will fill one of the few holes in Durham's thriving dining scene by adding a high-end, white tablecloth restaurant that caters to corporate executives and weekend special occasion customers. Nana Steak will feature entrees in the $30 to $40 range. Howell says there is a reason he has focused his expansion efforts on Durham over Raleigh. I've always found Raleigh to be generic and cliquish in a way Durham isn't, says Howell. It's no secret Durham is known nationally for its culinary culture. Just 2 years ago, Durham was named the South's tastiest town by Southern Living magazine. Last December, Travel and Leisure placed Durham on a global list of the best places to travel in 2015, noting that this once quiet corner of North Carolina's geeky research triangle is hitting its stride with a flurry of restaurant and hotel openings. In May, travel review company Zagat ranked Durham number 8 on its list of America's next hot food cities, based on the quality, character, and uniqueness of their restaurants. The list put Durham in company with Asheville, Nashville, and San Antonio. What's puzzling, however, is why Raleigh rarely lands that level of recognition. True, North Carolina's capital city is home to a number of celebrity chefs that garner significant local attention, and James Beard Award winner Ashley Christensen, whose restaurant group includes Poole's Diner, Beasley's Chicken and Honey, and Death and Taxes, has drawn praise in several national food columns. But as a city, Raleigh rarely draws national recognition as a venue for foodies. Those who follow the Triangle dining scene say that's because beyond the Beltline, Raleigh residents typically spend their money on chain restaurant fare rather than homegrown options. It's not that Raleigh residents aren't willing to spend money to dine out. Over the past years, the average yearly tab for Raleigh residents eating at full-service restaurants has increased 3.2% to $1,065, according to figures compiled by Esri, a Redlands, California-based geographical information systems company. Over the same period, Durham saw an anemic 0.7% increase to $843. But the diversity of options is greater in Durham, where there are 30.67 restaurants per 10,000 residents, compared to 21.93 in Raleigh. Raleigh-based Echelon Experiences owner Gaurav Patel says he has seen a shift in what diners are looking for when they go out to eat. Rather than dropping $30 on a single entree, diners are looking to get several smaller plates at a much lower price point. Echelon Experiences' newest restaurant, Fair, a surf and turf concept in Cameron Village, recently had to lower the prices on many of its menu items to meet customer expectations. More often, customers are viewing dining out as an experience, Patel says. Rather than having just one experience at a time, they're looking for three or four different experiences with their food and their cocktails. Shifting landscape. Restaurant analysts say Durham's foodie reputation might benefit from a number of key advantages over Raleigh. Despite being smaller geographically and having a lower population, the average salary is significantly higher in Durham. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Bull City's average salary in 2014 was $55,840, compared to $47,430 in Raleigh. The extra disposable income can go a long way in helping to support top-end restaurants, analysts say. Being home to a large private university with a more affluent student population doesn't hurt either. Howell says many of his best customers are students of Duke University. Many of these kids have a lot of money and are willing to spend it, says Nanas Howell. He adds that Duke University Hospital's employees are another key revenue base. There are also trends within the restaurant industry that make it harder for Raleigh to get credit for its more innovative restaurants. Bonnie Riggs, a restaurant industry analyst with the NPD Group in Chicago, says independent restaurants got hammered by the recent recession, which changed the way consumers view dining out. More often, restaurant goers are looking for food that is fast, cheap, and easy. So-called fast casual restaurants like Chipotle, Corner Bakery, and Panera have exploded in popularity in recent years. Consumers are also increasingly choosing to spend money at places like Whole Foods, where they can pick up pre-made meals to take home. Traditional fast food restaurants have also seen business hold steady, benefiting from huge marketing budgets and the ability to quickly recalibrate their offerings to meet consumer demand. But Riggs says independent restaurants have been losing ground as their slice of the dining dollar pie continues to shrink. Fewer independent restaurants are opening, and those that are have been forced to cut costs, particularly in larger cities like Raleigh, where competition is especially fierce. In addition, the growing number of restaurants in the Triangle region makes it difficult to find talented chefs and waitstaff, restaurant owners say. Since 2010, the population in Durham and Wake counties has grown by roughly 10%, and although the per capita ration is higher in Durham, the number of restaurants in both cities has kept pace with population growth. Durham, with a population of about 300,000, currently has nearly 900 restaurants. In Wake County, where the population is close to 1 million, the total number of restaurants is nearly 2,200. Meanwhile, millennials, especially those from more modest backgrounds, are dining out much less than their parents. Saddled with student debt and facing a tough job market, many millennials are opting to stay home and cook rather than go out to eat. Millennials with kids are really struggling and simply can't afford to go out as much, Riggs said. And today's kids no longer want to eat off the kids' menu, so when millennials go out, they're paying full price. That adds up for a family of four. Finding an edge. To stay competitive, independent restaurateurs are having to ensure that when customers do decide to leave the house, they feel the trip was worth it. That's driven a boom in tapas-style restaurants that seek to offer low prices and unique flavor profiles. Echelon's Patel says keeping up with consumer taste is a challenge because diners are becoming more sophisticated thanks to the popularity of food TV and the ubiquity of celebrity chefs in pop culture. Diners are also demanding more locally sourced ingredients and foods that are perceived as healthy. Kale and mushrooms were in vogue a year ago, so Patel reworked his menus to ensure he was offering appetizers and entrees that included those ingredients. If a kale salad is moving, infusing that into an entree can help to get that item moving as well, Patel says. Isolated innovation. In Raleigh, most of the innovation has been limited to downtown, which itself only in recent years became known as a local dining destination. Restaurateurs like Christensen and 18 restaurant group owner Jason Smith are heroes of the downtown Raleigh dining scene who find little trouble in attracting customers. But beyond the Beltline, Raleigh cuisine is more plain vanilla. Even when restaurant owners do try to bring high-end dining to other parts of the city, they are often met with resistance. Amber Moshakos, the daughter of LM Restaurant's founder Lou Moshakos, says her company jumped at the opportunity to move Taverna Agora from its Glenwood Avenue location on Raleigh's west side to its downtown location. "We cater to a lot of the locals who live near Pleasant Valley," Moshakos says. "But because we weren't around a ton of restaurants, we tended to be viewed as a special occasion place. Downtown is just a different market." LM Restaurants, which owns the Carolina Ale House chain of restaurants, will soon open another new concept downtown, Vidrio, will offer a broad range of Mediterranean cuisine and will anchor the bottom floors of the building where LM Restaurants opened its rooftop Carolina Ale House location. Machaco says Vidrio will offer plates in the $20 range and wines by the glass. LM Restaurants is also no stranger to the challenges facing high-end restaurants that operate even farther from downtown Raleigh. A few years ago, the company was forced to shutter Bentley's at Crossroads after the steak and seafood restaurant struggled to take off in its Cary location. It ended up being too high-end for where we were located, Machaco says. It shocked the market because when you think of places to have a high-end meal, you don't typically think of a shopping center. Hidden Gems. Despite its reputation for chain restaurants, Raleigh does have a few restaurants in non-downtown locations that strive to push the limits when it comes to offering interesting food to diners. Gonza Tacos and Tequila, which recently opened its second Raleigh location in the Aloft Hotel on Hillsborough Street, often has a line waiting outside its North Raleigh restaurant on Friday and Saturday nights. The restaurant specializes in creating modern twists on traditional Mexican fare. Mandolin on Fairview Road was recently awarded Distinguished Restaurants of America status, and the Angus Barn on the west side is repeatedly honored for its notable wine list. Another go-to is Margot's on Creedmoor Road, which changes its menu frequently to keep locals coming back several times a month to see what's new. These restaurants, either in suburban shopping centers or one-off locations, haven't provided enough momentum to create the foodie cluster that is typical of culinary destinations across the U.S., like Charleston, Austin, Nashville, and now Durham. But to keep their local customers happy, the chefs continue to provide innovative offerings. Steve Horowitz, co-owner of Margot's, says when he began offering New Zealand Red Deer on the menu not long ago, his staff couldn't keep up with demand. Recently, Horowitz has offered antelope, boar, and black grouper. "We're not sitting around waiting," Horowitz says. "We try to keep new items on special each day of the week. We don't have time to pay attention to what's going on in Durham." And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. New shop combines fashion and fitness. Malena Walston, wife of Raleigh real estate mogul Don Walston, has opened a new women's luxury activewear boutique at the Lafayette Village Retail Center in North Raleigh that she says will provide alternatives to the popular Lululemon shops in Raleigh and Durham. "I'm originally from Canada, so I'm very familiar with Lululemon and was wearing it long before it ever came to Raleigh," she says of the Vancouver-based brand. "But I've also noticed there's a huge void in this market in fashion activewear." The shop, called Lisana Activewear and named after both her Lisbon-Portugal heritage and her Canadian roots, will be carrying hard-to-find brands from around the world that range in price from $39 for tops and $86 for bottoms. Walston also hinted that work is also underway for her own line of activewear apparel. "But I'm really focusing on this store right now and making this work," she says. Old Chatham honors first chairman with tourney. Old Chatham Golf Club will rename its annual Fall Invitational Golf Tournament the Paul J. Rizzo Invitational in honor of the first and only chairman of the club. Rizzo, also a member of Augusta National Golf Club, is the chairman emeritus of Franklin Street Partners, a private investment management firm and trust company in Chapel Hill. He retired from his position as vice chairman of the board of IBM in 1994. Rizzo is the former dean of the UNC Chapel Hill Keenan Flagler Business School and a former member of the UNC System Board of Governors. He is also a past director of Johnson & Johnson, McGraw-Hill Education, Morgan Stanley, Maersk Incorporated, and Cox Enterprises. In 1999, Rizzo joined with other influential business and political leaders to form Old Chatham and was instrumental in working with leading golf course architect Reese Jones to design the course. Already, the tournament has been nicknamed simply the Rizzo. "Paul is a champion of amateur golf and a friend to anyone who loves the unmatchable quality of Old Chatham," says John Marino, director of operations at Old Chatham. When we host the Rizzo next year, guests will be amazed at how integral he has been in making the club a beloved home for golfers across the country and around the world. When the chips are down, make hot sauce. When the commercial real estate markets were tanking in 2010, Raleigh retail real estate developer Austin Williams says he was playing around with some hot sauce ingredients and came up with a recipe that he's now expanding into grocery stores across North Carolina. Called the Shizzle, Williams says he's now has teamed up with Jed Drake to form a company to sell the sauce, Big and Fine Food Company. Bottles of the all-natural marinade are now being sold at Whole Foods and Lowe's food stores across the state. Was it the chili? Barker causes roar with big bid on Tigers. Local business owner Bob Barker, CEO of the prison supply firm Bob Barker Company, shocked the crowd at Fuquay Varina's downtown chili cook-off event November 7, when during the live auction for three of the town's Bengal Tigers on parade, he raised the bid for the first one to $5,000. Then, when prompted by the auctioneer, Barker agreed to buy all three for a flat price of $15,000, an event that organizers had optimistically hoped would raise between $3,000 and $6,000. Barker, who is already a sponsor of the Public Art Initiative, says he plans to donate each of the Tiger art pieces to three of the town's public schools. The Bengal Tiger is the mascot of Fuquay Varina High School. And finally, in a section called You Said It, reader Facebook comments on recent TBJ stories. On Charlotte Mall exec, we made a mistake removing Christmas tree. Moss Withers says, ha, crazy stuff. Good for them to listen. It looks so sterile without the tree. And on Old Varsity Theater on Raleigh's Hillsborough Street to be transformed into restaurant bar, Carl Denning Mordock says, love it. This is a cool space but has needed some love for a while now. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Sprouts Anchored Center Coming to North Raleigh. Developers of Olive Park, a new North Raleigh neighborhood shopping center project that's already passed muster with its neighbors and the city's rezoning authorities, has signed a lease commitment with the Sprouts Farmers Market grocery chain for what is slated to be the specialty growers' first location in the Triangle region. The project is a development of Raleigh-based D&N Development, a company formed in 2013 by the father and son duo of Daniel Brown and Nick Brown, who have been working for 2 years to get the approvals needed to start construction as early as late February. Olive Park will be named after Nick Brown's 5-year-old daughter, Olive. The 65,620-square-foot center will be located at the intersection of Falls of Neuse and Litchford Roads, adjacent to the new BB&T Bank building. Other tenants signed for the center include a Bad Daddy's Burger Bar restaurant, which will have an outdoor rooftop dining element, as well as a city barbecue restaurant location, Chronic Tacos Restaurant, a Papa Murphy's Pizza, Supercuts, Lee Spa Nails, and Sleepy's Mattress. Nick Brown says he still has another 14,000 square feet of retail space available for lease at Olive Park. Once D&N receives administrative site plan approval from the city, construction could start as early as late February, with the first shops opening in November 2016. The Sprouts would likely open in early 2017. J. Davis Architects founder stepping down as CEO. Jeff Davis, founder, president, and CEO of one of the Triangle's largest Raleigh-based architecture firms, J. Davis Architects, is relinquishing his top management roles in the firm and handing the reins over to two longtime partners. Larry Zucchino, who helped start the firm with Davis in 2001, is being promoted to chief executive officer. Neil Gray, who joined as a principal in the company shortly after it began, will take over as president. Davis will remain involved with the firm, but focusing more on client management and project design. J. Davis Architects recently moved its headquarters office from the 510 Glenwood Avenue mixed-use building to Charter Square on Fayetteville Street. And in a section called Top Deals, we have the top commercial real estate transactions for October. The real estate capital markets in October spent close to $316 million in commercial property transactions in the Triangle, which brings the year-to-date total to more than $3 billion, according to a Triangle Business Journal database of property sales of more than $7.5 million. Here were some of the top deals for October 2015. Keystone Technology Park. The deal, Longfellow Real Estate Partners paid $118 million for 11 office and flex buildings at Keystone Technology Park on Davis Drive in Durham on October 2nd. The profit, the seller, Lionstone Group, paid $88.8 million for the same portfolio in 2011, a 33% increase. The Exchange at Briar Creek. The deal, Gray Company Incorporated, a Richmond-based real estate investment firm, paid $37.4 million for 274-unit The Exchange at Briar Creek apartment community at 9240 Bruckhaw Street in Northwest Raleigh on October 16. The profit, the seller, Waterton Residential Property Fund X of Chicago, paid $28.3 million for the complex in 2010, a 32% increase. Golden State Foods, the deal, an affiliate of Chicago-based Oak Street Real Estate Capital, GSNC 002 LLC, paid $35.26 million for the Golden State Foods Industrial Building at 1400 North Greenfield Parkway in Garner on October 26. The profit, the seller, was another affiliate of Oak Street Capital, GSNC 001 LLC, which paid $25.9 million for the building in 2011, a 36% increase. And finally, Falls Village Shopping Center. The deal, Stockbridge Capital, paid $39.5 million for the 190,139-square-foot shopping center at 6647 Falls of Neuse Road in Raleigh on October 22. The profit, the seller, a joint venture between RCG Ventures and DRA Advisors, paid $23 million for the center in 2012, a 2% increase. And finally, Concord Hospitality ramping up hotel expansion in Durham and Raleigh. Mark LaPorte, founder, president, and CEO of the Raleigh-based hotel development and management firm, Concord Hospitality Enterprises, is bullish about his company's local prospects. After selling both its Renaissance Hotel and Hyatt House Hotel at North Hills earlier this year for $101 million, two of the company's most profitable properties in the region, LaPorte says they are looking for new opportunities. On November 6, Concord, through a joint venture partnership with Florida-based Finfarb Companies, purchased the aging Brookwood Inn across from the Durham VA Medical Center on Irwin Road for $10.2 million. The partners plan to invest about $6 million into the 148-room hotel's renovation and rebranding as a more high-profile Cambria Suites in 2016, he says. Concord opened a new Residence Inn by Marriott on Main Street in Durham in 2015. Concord also plans to break ground November 6, along with its partners at Raleigh-based Kane Realty Corporation, on the new AC Hotel at North Hills, a $28 million project. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, Dissecting the Future of the Triangle CRO Industry. Quarterly earnings reports revealed more than just the line items of revenue and expenses, and the most recent quarter gives an interesting takeaway for the future of Triangle Area pharmaceutical research companies. Beyond the standard profit and loss statement, analysts take a close look at a company's book-to-bill ratio, an indicator of future demand. A book-to-bill ratio of 1 would mean the company booked exactly as much as it billed in that quarter. A ratio above 1 means more bookings and more future business than in the most recent quarter. By that measure, Durham-based Quintiles gave up ground to local competitors like Raleigh-based PRA Health Sciences, Raleigh-based Inc. Research, and Boston-based Parexel. Quintiles reported a book-to-bill ratio of 1.06 for the 3 months ended September 30, while the other companies recorded a ratio of at least 1.2. Inc. led the pack of four with a 1.4 ratio. As one of the world's largest pharma research outsource companies, Quintiles is larger than most competitors. Quintiles reported $1.16 billion of net new business for the quarter, and its backlog of $11.75 billion is more than the other three combined. Typically, a large company will not be able to grow as quickly as a successful small company in terms of percentage growth. But Quintiles CEO Tom Pike says the company will look to pick up sales, particularly as future business was impacted by the cancellation of a large project. In comparing the share prices for these companies, investors view the two larger CROs, Quintiles and Parexel, quite differently from the smaller ones, Inc. Research and PRA, at least by one measure. Quintiles has a price-to-earnings ratio of 22, and Parexel has a price-to-earnings ratio of 27. On the other end of the spectrum, Inc. and PRA have price-to-earning ratios of 79 and 83, respectively. Federal agency rules Duke researcher falsified research. The federal government ruled November 9 that Anil Patti, the disgraced former Duke University researcher, falsified research. Patti, once considered a star for some of his findings, fell from grace when questions about the legitimacy of his research surfaced. The research unraveled and lawsuits followed. More than 10 academic papers related to Patti's were retracted, according to Retraction Watch. Patti claimed to have found an amazing breakthrough in cancer treatment. Duke University started a clinical trial to test the possible new treatment on cancer patients. However, Patti's research was later questioned, and some of the cancer patients in the trial died. In May, Duke settled for an undisclosed amount the lawsuits brought by patients and estates of patients who participated in these trials. In interviews, Duke officials have admitted making mistakes. The November 9 ruling comes from the Office of Research Integrity and in some ways bookends the Patti saga. It officially rules that Patti engaged in research misconduct by including false research data in published papers, submitted manuscript, grant application, and the research record. Duke offered a statement November 9. We are pleased with the finding of research misconduct by the Federal Office of Research Integrity related to work done by Dr. Anil Patti. We trust this will serve to fully absolve the clinicians and researchers who were unwittingly associated with his actions and bring closure to others who were affected. And in a section called She Said It, this is a quote from Cindy Whitehead, CEO of Sprout Pharmaceuticals. Speaking at NC State University as part of the NCSU Poole College of Management Speaker Series, Sprout, the Raleigh company that achieved the first ever FDA approval for a drug to treat a sexual disorder in women, has been growing quickly. Since the company was acquired by Valeant Pharmaceuticals for an all-cash deal worth $1 billion, the company has grown by about 440%. The company now has a sales force of 150 throughout the U.S. and another 40 workers in the home office in North Hills. Whitehead does not like the analogy to Pfizer's Viagra and wishes the comparisons would stop. Her quote, "The media has dubbed us the female Viagra. I wish they wouldn't." And finally, in a section called Big Number, that big number is $2 billion. Chapel Hill-based drug developer Cardioxyl Pharmaceuticals Incorporated will be acquired by Bristol-Myers Squibb Company in a deal that could ultimately be worth more than $2 billion. Bristol-Myers Squibb will pay $300 million upfront and for near-term milestones, and up to nearly $1.8 billion more depending on future achievements. In 2006, Cardioxyl raised $14.5 million in a Series A funding round. and in 2012 it raised $28 million in a Series B. The company has not received funding from the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. The company is in the process of developing an experimental drug identified as CXL-1427, which has demonstrated beneficial effects on heart muscle and vascular function in studies. And now we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Spoonflower hires its first chief financial officer. Durham fabric printer Spoonflower has decided how to invest some of that $25 million it raised earlier this year. Nearly 3 months later, Spoonflower has hired its first chief financial officer. Jennifer Turnage, the former CFO of Consolidated Asset Recovery Systems and Channel Advisor, has been tapped to help the company manage its growth and the skyrocketing demand for its custom fabric, wallpaper, and gift wrap, per a company statement. Turnage, a self-described entrepreneur at heart, says the growth potential attracted her to Spoonflower. Spoonflower, which got its start 7 years ago in an old sock mill in Mebane, now occupies more than 35,000 square feet in Durham and has 155 employees. It's the kind of growth trajectory she says she's familiar with. After an early stint with PricewaterhouseCoopers, she connected with serial entrepreneur Scott Wingo, working with him on both AuctionRover.com and Channel Advisor. Eventually, she started her own company, which provided part-time CFO services for startup companies such as Strike Iron, later bought by Informatica, and Digital Smiths, later bought by TiVo. It's how she connected with Consolidated Asset Recovery Systems, where she spent the next 7 years. I really like that early growth stage company where you come in, you have a product and customers, but then you have the fun challenge of figuring how, where do you go from here? She says, and the company's recent equity raise is an opportunity, she says. It's very exciting to see a company, a local company, raise that kind of capital. Google Fiber may take 2 years in Raleigh. Dirt moving is only the beginning of lengthy process. While Google Fiber is staying mum about the specifics of its multi-city rollout plan, the city of Raleigh is starting to offer some hints. After confirming that both Google Fiber and AT&T are currently building infrastructure within city limits, Noah Otto, Raleigh's right-of-way services coordinator, said to expect a lengthy process. Right now, we're looking at least 2 years, if not longer, he says. It's all throughout Raleigh. It's a pretty large plan. City officials say the first sign that fiber is coming to your neighborhood will be a series of colorful markings on the ground. Those markings warn contractors of where utility lines are so that they can be aware of them as they dig. Google Fiber still hasn't released a time frame as to when its service will be available, but its competitor, AT&T, has been doubling down on its own build-out. AT&T announced this month that its high-speed service, which has already launched in parts of the Triangle, including Raleigh, just launched in Garner and Holly Springs. And finally, in a section called By the Numbers, Channel Advisor downplays customer count. Channel Advisor, a Morrisville-based e-commerce software company, reported 2,910 customers during its most recent earnings call. While the number is flat year over year, CEO David Spitz says that's not how you should judge success. The smallest 1,000 of the customer base accounted for just 7% of revenue in the quarter, while the top 100 customers accounted for 26% of the revenue. Greater than $32,000, average deal size. 12, the number of customers generating at least $100,000, and $24.4 million total revenue for the third quarter. And now we turn to the On Transportation page, written by Jeff Jeffrey. The main headline, proposed Raleigh-Norfolk corridor clears U.S. House. Transportation officials in North Carolina and Virginia are awaiting the outcome of a congressional conference committee to see whether the entire highway corridor between Raleigh and Norfolk, Virginia, might eventually become part of the federal interstate system. The U.S. House approved a $339 billion transportation bill last week that included the proposal to designate the Raleigh-Norfolk corridor as a high-priority corridor. High-priority corridors are eligible for federal funds to assist states in upgrading highways. The House approved the bill in a 363-64 vote. H.R. 22 would ensure highway and transit projects are funded for up to 6 years. However, additional funding mechanisms may be required to ensure that spending during the final 3 years of the bill is covered. The legislation now heads to a conference committee with the Senate before it can be sent to President Barack Obama for his signature. The Senate has also approved giving the Raleigh-Norfolk corridor priority status. While it was still under construction by the House, the entire North Carolina congressional delegation and 4 of Virginia's 11 representatives came out in support of the measure. If it becomes law, the priority status would apply to U.S. Route 64 from Raleigh through Rocky Mount, Williamston and Elizabeth City, to U.S. 17 in Norfolk. Once the segments of U.S. Route 64 and U.S. 17 meet certain requirements, they would become part of the federal interstate system. The Federal Highway Administration estimates $1 billion in transportation funding can support approximately 30,000 jobs. This is a big deal for North Carolina, but especially Wake County. The Raleigh-Cary area is one of just a few large metro regions in the eastern U.S. that doesn't have two-digit interstates, says Joe Malazzo, executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance Business Coalition. Adding a second one would send a signal to travelers and future economic development opportunities that we're a priority for the federal interstate system. And in a section called She Said It, the quote is from Pam Heminger, incoming Chapel Hill mayor, on her intent to re-examine plans for the proposed Durham-Orange light rail line to ensure the route is the correct one for the region. "We need to ensure we get the route right for economic development purposes, as well as ensuring it reaches the most people." RDU gets seasonal flight to Cancun. American Airlines is bolstering competition with Delta Airlines on the route from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to Cancun. American Airlines has confirmed it is preparing to begin weekly service between RDU and Cancun starting March 5. Flights will leave RDU each Saturday at 7:05 a.m. Return flights will also be on Saturdays and will leave Cancun International Airport at 10:25 a.m. American Airlines spokeswoman Laura Nedball says the flight will run from March through the end of the summer before starting back up again in November. Each year, she says, the airline is still working out the exact dates of the season. The new RDU to Cancun route is one of 4 American Airlines is adding to its portfolio. The airline will also begin offering seasonal service to Cancun out of Pittsburgh International Airport, Nashville International Airport, and Kansas City International Airport. Delta began offering seasonal service to Cancun from RDU in 2008. RDU spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin says it's been a popular route among customers. "We always value additional service to popular vacation destinations that we know our passengers like," Hamlin says. Just a few months ago, RDU announced it will begin offering service to Paris in May, adding a service the Triangle community has long pushed for. RDU is now focusing its efforts on expanding its offerings to domestic destinations like Austin, Texas, San Diego, Kansas City, Missouri, New Orleans, and Portland, Oregon. The airport has also identified San Juan, Puerto Rico as a target for new service. And now we turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal. And we start with the column written by Todd Cohen, who publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline, Respite for Families of Sick Children. On April 15, Ronald McDonald House of Durham began offering overnight stays in 5 rooms donated by WakeMed in its Heart Center Inn in Raleigh to families of critically ill pediatric patients at WakeMed Children's Hospital. Through September, the new WakeMed house already had provided 630 overnight stays. And with demand from families growing, Ronald McDonald House of Durham is now considering whether to establish a new Ronald McDonald House to serve families of pediatric patients at WakeMed, says O.E. Osterkamp, executive director. Launched in 1980 with 13 beds, Ronald McDonald House of Durham was the first of what now are five Ronald McDonald organizations in the state, operating a total of seven houses. The others are in Chapel Hill, Charlotte, Greenville, and Winston-Salem. The Durham House, located near Duke University Hospital, grew to 29 rooms in 2011 and was expanded to 55 rooms in October 2012 after a capital campaign that raised $7.2 million. Last year, it provided 16,200 overnight stays. Ronald McDonald House also operates separate family rooms at Duke University Hospital and WakeMed that together serve more than 40,000 parents a year. Ronald McDonald House operates with an annual budget of about $2 million, plus $500,000 to $600,000 in estimated in-kind donations, a staff of 12 people working full-time and 12 working part-time, and 4,500 volunteers. This year, it expects to generate most of its $1.85 million budget through contributions, revenue from annual fundraising breakfasts, and a Heart of Gold Gala at the Angus Barn in Raleigh. It also receives support from McDonald's Corporation, individual owner-operators of local McDonald's restaurants, and their local advertising co-op, as well as investment income from its $3 million endowment. In June, Ronald McDonald House launched a new Security Blanket Society to recognize and encourage planned gifts, says Nancy Jones, Senior Director of Development and Communications. And building on an existing program that offers donors an opportunity to sponsor a room or suite in its Durham house. Ronald McDonald House has begun offering donors the opportunity to endow or adopt a room or suite. We ask for $10 a night for families to stay here, and 70% of families can't afford that, Osterkamp says. At the Durham House, sponsors already are covering the annual cost to families of about 20 rooms. And Aaron and Natalie Kane of Fayetteville have made a $100,000 commitment to endow a room at the Durham House named for their late son, Wells McRae Kane, and have created an annual memorial golf tournament to raise the endowment funds. After Wells was born with congenital heart defect, he was airlifted to Duke Hospital. The Kane spent 2 weeks at the Durham House before Wells died. Jones says the endowment will make a big difference for families that need to stay at Ronald McDonald House. And in nonprofit news, Junior League helps feed hungry kids. The Junior League of Raleigh expanded its interfaith food shuttle, Backpack Buddies, partnership this school year. Children benefiting from this program receive nutritious meals and snacks, including fresh fruits and shelf-stable food and milk for the weekend. In North Carolina, one in five kids under the age of 18 does not have enough to eat, making our state the ninth highest in the country for child food insecurity, says Catherine West, president of the Junior League of Raleigh. We believe hunger is unacceptable for youth in Wake County, West says, and we are thrilled that the program has been able to expand to include more children across our community. Biogen grants foster STEM education. The Biogen Foundation announced a $125,000 competitive grants program designed to support science education programs and projects in North Carolina's public schools. Entitled Ignite the Power of STEM, the grants are awarded to teachers, schools, and nonprofit STEM education programs that serve K-12 students to promote science literacy in innovative ways among students, encourage equal access, quality STEM education, and inspire students to pursue STEM careers. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to this edition's Executive Voice Q&A. With Harry Buck Hunt IV, the headline, Home Building Risks and Rewards, CEO of H.H. Hunt says diversification is key to surviving a recession. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. After several years of building his own business in South Florida, after college, Harry Buck Hunt IV eventually couldn't resist the inevitable that he would one day rejoin the Virginia Development and Home Building Company his father started, H.H. Hunt. But instead of going back home to Blacksburg, Hunt made what's turned out to be a more permanent stop in 2003 at the company's growing office in Raleigh. In 2013, H.H. Hunt went through a major leadership transition after two of the company's top executives decided to retire. Instead of shifting, Hunt, who was promoted to vice chairman and chief executive officer, and new company president Daniel Schmidt, who was based in Richmond, back to the company's legacy headquarters in Blacksburg, where chairman Harry Hunt is still based, the company's executive team as a whole decided to keep everyone where they were happy, giving the company three headquarters instead of just one. With the technology we have today and all the traveling we were already doing, we don't have to be in the same place, Buck Hunt says. We all make a point to shift around to each other's markets, and it works. The company now owns and manages 21 senior living communities and 15 apartment communities, and is developing in more than 20 new single-family communities from Maryland to Savannah, Georgia. H.H. Hunt was founded by your father, Harry Hunt, in 1966. Does that bring additional pressure on you now as vice chairman and CEO? There is certainly pressure to live up to the successes that he and his group of core leaders achieved over almost 50 years together. It is humbling to think about the fact that those guys were younger than I am now, starting up a company from nothing and working to grow it to where it is today. Being the founder's son brings another dimension. There is a different kind of pressure when you have a family connection. There are always people who will judge your successes and failures through that lens. What were you doing in Florida during those early years? I was living in Boca Raton. I worked for a local chamber of commerce, had a stint with a web-based promotions company, and started a business with a partner I met there. When you moved to the Triangle back in 2003, that was a pretty good time for the construction and home building industries, but when the recession hit, how did H.H. Hunt fare? Obviously, if you were in home building or land development, it was a dire time. Sales were falling, land appraisals were falling, banks were all over you. A lot of very smart and capable people got wiped out. We had a few very significant land positions that really came back to bite us, and we had to work through those problems with our lending partners. Fortunately, we had very good banking relationships built up over a long period of time, and we had great leadership in the company that helped see us through. There were some things totally out of our control that could have made life very difficult, and we just got lucky that they went the right way for us. It is also hard to overstate how much we were saved in large part due to our diversification. Our portfolio of income-producing assets, apartments and assisted living, were able to sustain the company during those very lean times. Where we had real difficulty on that side was just trying to do new deals. We had a lot of projects in the pipeline from 2007 to 2010, but getting the financing to do them became a real challenge. Impossible in some instances. We generally utilize various HUD programs for financing for our apartments and assisted living. When the conventional lending started to dry up, many developers ran to HUD, creating a huge logjam in their processing. What would you say has been your biggest challenge yet in your career in the company? Everyone has their own beliefs and views on leadership, management, and what drives success. When you come into a leadership position, you want to be able to implement your philosophy. With H.H. Hunt, we're talking about a very mature company with a well-established culture. So for our new leadership team, aligning our views with that of the rest of the company has occasionally been a challenge, particularly for those who have been with us for a long time. We are bringing new ideas and trying to implement changes that we believe will set the company up well for future growth and success. Gaining buy-in can be an emotional and difficult process at times, but so far I think we're doing a pretty good job moving all that ahead. How are you and your executive team at H.H. Hunt trying to get trying to better position the company for the next downturn cycle, whenever that will be. One of the first things that we started doing was set aside some reserve capital each year. That was a big step for the company because we have always been about constantly reinvesting 90% of what we make back into the growth of the company. So diverting some of that cash each year into reserve really goes against the historical norm for us, but it is part of our safety net. We have also implemented some additional checklists based on lessons learned, and we try to look ahead and see how the timing of our longer-term projects is setting up. No one can predict the future, but we watch as many leading economic indicators as we can. In a sense, reserve cash is one of the easiest tactics you can undertake as part of a larger strategy. It is more challenging to maintain a discipline and vigilance on every deal to make sure you stick to your criteria. Don't make overly ambitious assumptions. Have an exit strategy and be willing to pull the plug well ahead of danger when you see it on the horizon. There is so much pressure to keep moving forward, even when you see the hints of dark clouds. Having the stomach to take a step back and say stop before things have actually turned south takes fortitude. What's your forecast for the triangle development and construction market over the next 12 months, next 2 years? In what sectors and in what communities will most of the growth be happening? The triangle is always going to be a very attractive to a wide variety of real estate products because we have such a diverse set of economic drivers here. You have all the universities, RTP, the state government, and a quality of life that attracts people. From my viewpoint today, over the next year or two, I see Northern Wake, Wake Forest, and Southwestern Wake continuing to be good submarkets. I think growth will keep pushing south and southeast. As the years progress, I think you'll continue to see a need for all manner of products, both residential and commercial. Suburban office, retail, and residential would continue to be my primary bets long term, although you can see the urban core as being an opportunity as well. I'd love to see that part of the region develop even more. What are some of your hobbies? Fitness, snow skiing, cooking, music, travel. I'm also a bit of a news hound, and I have a guilty pleasure of firing up my son's PS4 and playing video games from time to time. What keeps you awake at night? The thought of losing any of our best people. And now we turn to the viewpoint page for the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Networking Lessons Learned from CEOs. Before the start of our annual Fast 50 Awards event on November 10, we had a 30-minute CEO reception in an adjacent room at the Raleigh Convention Center. What struck me most in that short time is the insatiable appetite of owners and presidents to do deals, learn of best practices, and swap success stories. Our Fast 50 event recognizes the fastest-growing private companies in the Triangle area. There is a nomination process, which means if companies are not nominated, they are not considered for the award. Even more important is the selection and the ranking of the 50 companies. These private companies have to open up their books to our event partner, PricewaterhouseCoopers, which verifies and certifies the financials before using a profitability algorithm to finalize the list. This generally levels the playing field for growth stage companies and well-established companies that may have more than $100 million in revenue. In essence, everyone present in that pre-event reception has a formula to be successful in enterprise. Learn, market, and execute. From Coldwell Banker's Don Walston to Jacobs Capital's Michael Jacobs, and from LM Restaurant's Lou Mishakis to Captive Air's Bob Luddy, these CEOs paid close attention to what their peers were saying. Once the listening was over, they seized the opportunity to brand their company culture and how it ties to profitability. Discussions revolved around properties for sale to potential buy of new equipment to bolster productivity, but these CEOs spent the most time talking about capital markets. The entire conversation may have lasted 5 minutes, but it was the content of that conversation that mattered. Many of the exchanges ended with, "I will call you to set up lunch," and then they were off to the ballroom for the main event. When a CEO interacts with someone who is a peer, the discussion is far beyond just peddling specific products and services. It often is about operational strategy. And for some others, it is even beyond their daily work. They want to talk about education, sports, politics, and leadership. More often than not, they have their own opinions on these subjects, but in a public setting, they quickly figure out the commonalities and focus the conversation on that specific matter. We can all learn from this communication style. It saves us time, it offers us clarity, and it makes for an honest and satisfying dialogue. In my 15 to 20 minutes in that room before the main event, it was easy to see why these companies were the fastest growing in our area. And in our final minutes, we'll read from the People on the Move page. The spotlight is on Julie Gasper, General Manager of Carolina Premium Outlets, Smithfield. A veteran of Simon Property Group, Julie Gasper has been named General Manager of its Carolina Premium Outlets property in Smithfield. In her new position, Gasper is responsible for overseeing the overall advancement of the financial, marketing, and operational performance of the property. She also oversees a staff of about 10. Carolina Premium Outlets in Smithfield offers 83 stores, including flagship brands such as Polo, Ralph Lauren, Nike, and Gap. According to Simon's website, the property is situated on about 52 acres in Johnston County and has a total of 439,000 gross leasable square feet. Indianapolis-based Simon Property Group is a publicly traded real estate investment trust that employs more than 3,500 people. The $60 billion market cap company is helmed by David Simon. What is one thing you wish people knew about your job? It's busier than someone might think, and there is a great deal of interaction with not only the tenants, but also the shoppers. Major goals in your position? I look forward to working with our Creative Director of Marketing and Business Development, Karen Henthorne, in bringing many creative ideas to light for the center and with our valued team on operational projects that will make Carolina Premium Outlets even more of a premier shopping destination. I also strive to enhance our shoppers' experience. Biggest pet peeve, clutter, and biggest worry, not meeting deadlines. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.